Welcome to Business on 570 News. Your hosts, Ian McLean of the Greater Kitchener-Waterloo Chamber of Commerce and Greg DeRocher. He is the president of the Cambridge Chamber of Commerce. It's business to business, powered by Allstream. And on that note, our first guest, gentlemen, is Todd Ramsey. He is director of sales for the Central Region for Allstream. And gentlemen, take it away.
Well, Todd, it's Greg DeRocher. It's great to have you on. Actually, not the first presentation of Allstream, but, of course, the second presentation. We had your fine president on in our first, the inaugural show in August, and but you're really the individual that's going to be touching the streets and touching the businesses here in the Waterloo region, representing Allstream. And congratulations, and thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thank you very much, Greg. It's a pleasure to join both you and Ian on the air today.
You know, the question of how does technology help me grow my business is probably something that every business owner goes through. You know, where do I turn? What do I do? How do I engage in my not just my business, but my people in technology? So, you know, part of the Allstream mantra is really, you know, dealing with that virtual workforce and utilizing technology to not necessarily have, you know, the hands on, but dealing with a virtual workforce. So how do I deal with that as a small business owner?
That's an excellent question. Technology becomes really an enabler an empowerment for an organization to look at how they extend themselves beyond the physical structure that they have, mm-hmm. while ensuring that they're reaching the customers in the most effective and efficient manner. Mm-hmm. And so if you look at the tools that are required to enable an employee. In the past, you know, you needed the physical structure, the four walls. You needed a hard network. You needed the phone lines. You needed all of those tools that a person had to go into the office to access. Mm-hmm. With the dramatic change in technology, all of that's changed. In fact, the rules really have been thrown out the window. You know, as long as you have an individual with a mobile device, with an internet connection, and some kind of a soft phone or an IP internet protocol phone, they can be virtually anywhere and working for you and driving efficiency for the organization.
And everybody thinks you're sitting in an office, of course.
Absolutely. I mean, the systems right now are so sophisticated that calling into a central number and then being routed locally or globally, for that matter, is really just, you know, a couple of bits and bytes.
Mm-hmm. Well, Todd, we have everyone talks about talks about the cloud and how that new technology and that new system can benefit business. So maybe first just explain what the cloud is. I mean, I think I always hear some small and medium sized business folks not really understand what it is and how it can help them. And I guess intertwined in that is, I think there's, when you're not sure about what the technology is, you have questions about what's the security like. What's the reliability when you have something off-site versus having a server or that sort of thing? And what are the costs? Like, what are the cost savings or what are the downstroke costs to get up and running? So what is the cloud and how can it meet the business goals of our members?
Again, that's a great question. So there has been a lot of noise and a lot of buzz about cloud and cloud computing, and it's in reality, it's not a new concept. It's a concept that's been around for a while. But I think that, again, as businesses become more and more conscious about their own operating funds, both capital and operating, in fact, the cloud computing becomes more and more attractive. So, you know, to answer your first question, what is cloud and cloud computing? Really what it's on-demand access to computing power, whether that's an application or backup facilities or shared resources, so that you have the elasticity and scalability of a much larger organization, really without the added cost of investing in significant hardware and significant support for that hardware. Another nice benefit is, you know, rapid provisioning. In a non-cloud environment, if we wanted to roll out as a new company an upgrade to, I don't know, we'll pick something like an Office platform, so Microsoft Outlook. That would consume enormous amounts of resources internally as we went through that process. The same thing could be done in a cloud environment at a provider's location without the added cost of the equipment, without the added cost of maintenance, and really just optimizing really the economies of scale. When you look at, again, a workforce wherever they are, we all carry some type of mobile device around, and often we're accessing, whether it's our own personal email or corporate emails. That reliability of that, has become more and more critical as business has evolved, to the point where, once upon a time the phone was the critical piece of business equipment, and I would actually argue that, email and access to information that's corporately held is probably more critical. And so when you look at reliability, anybody who's looking at cloud computing and really an outsourced model, I'll use an older term there, because that's really what we're talking about is outsourcing part of the technical requirements of your organization to reduce the resources you have, but to reallocate them into a better place. And so as you look at ensuring that the provider or the customer has access to the information continually, when you look at a cloud provider, are they, what kind of backup facilities do they have? Is there a redundant power source coming in? Because it can be accessible, but the data is housed somewhere, and if that where it's housed, the power goes out, that's certainly going to have a performance impact if it's no longer available.
You are listening to Business on 570 News, powered by Allstream. We're in conversation with Todd Ramsey. He is the director of sales for Central Region for Allstream. And over to you, Ian. Over to you, Greg.
Todd, we could probably go on and on and on, because this disaster recovery and business continuity thing is of real concern to small businesses that, I know in my own operation at the Chamber of Commerce, the power goes out and the computers are down, the phone system's down. Everybody just kind of sits around and looks at each other and wonders what the heck they're going to do next. And I've gone through a disastrous situation, losing all my data and that kind of thing. But, what does Allstream bring to the table to give me that sense of security and that sense of comfort that my business, these disaster recovery ideas are going to be taken care of and I'm going to have that business continuity?
I think that's a great question, and the answer, we could talk for hours on that particular topic alone, but the way in which we've approached disaster recovery, business continuity, is to take a very close look at the needs of the customer, and not just today's needs, but what are your needs in the next 3 years, 5 years, and beyond? Because the decisions we make today about business continuity and disaster recovery really are far-reaching. So if we made a decision to go down a certain path because you felt that you really only needed a backup solution, so it was a non-critical application, but then suddenly that application became critical for your business, that could require a significant amount of rework. So what we'd like to do is spend some time with our customers, understand really not just their business, but how their customers view their business. Yep. So in effect, using technology to assist them to make it easier to serve their customers, and then determine what really is critical. Mm-hmm. So, if you lost access to your database for, 20 minutes or 30 minutes, is that really a critical issue? Well, it may be if you're a banking institution or if you're a retail store doing transactions.
Sometimes it's just a nice break in the day.
Indeed it is.
Todd, we appreciate you coming on, and we'll look forward to hearing from you and your colleagues from Allstream every couple of weeks. I think we announced last last time, our last show, that we'll be live every second week now on 570. And so we look forward to hearing more from you on many of these subjects that the business should be aware of and be thinking about as they try and grow and increase their business. So thanks for joining us this morning.
Well, thank you very much. I certainly appreciate the time. And for those individuals that are out there that do have questions that we're certainly welcome to assist with. Welcome to give us a call. If you don't mind, I'll just give out the number.
Absolutely.
It's 877-815-9119, and the team there would be more than willing to help out in answering any questions and guiding the business community down the appropriate path with technology.
Thank you very much, Todd.
Okay, thank you. Have a great day, guys.
It's Todd Ramsey. He is the Director of Sales Central Region for Allstream. Now, when we come back, we're going to talk about the upcoming by-election, which takes place on Thursday. We're going to examine it again from a business perspective. We've got representatives from the various parties lined up to talk to us this evening, so we look forward to talking to them. That and more as Business to Business, powered by Allstream, continues. Welcome back to Business on 570 News, powered by Allstream, with your hosts, Ian McLean, president of the Greater Kitchener-Waterloo Chamber of Commerce, and Greg DeRocher. He is the president of the Cambridge Chamber of Commerce. And we're in conversation with Mike Schreiner now. He is the leader of the Ontario Green Party.
Mike, what I'd like to ask you is, and I know I don't want to beat the Drummond report to death because it has been, but there were 362 very strategic recommendations that he made in that report. And, of course, we know that not all of them were adopted. But he was very concise in his presentation of that report to say, more or less he's done the forensic analysis here and come up with these 362 recommendations to make it all work. And if you don't take them all, then it's not going to work. And you have to, throw in some new and better ideas in order to make up that balance. But what we really haven't heard from, we heard from the NDP and we heard from the Conservatives as to what they would do with Mr. McGuinty's response to that report. I don't think we've really heard what the Green Party's response would have been to that Drummond report.
Yeah, so the Green Party, we firmly believe Ontario has to get its fiscal house in order. I mean, I think it's outrageous that we're spending over $10 billion a year just paying interest payments on debt. And that's money, frankly, that should be going into essential public services like health care and education, not interest payments. And so we supported a number of the Drummond recommendations. As a matter of fact, during the fall provincial election, we were the only party that really had the courage to stand up and have an honest conversation with Ontarians that we needed to address the provincial debt. And one of my biggest disappointments in the other three parties, and particularly the government, is that one of the biggest savings that the Drummond report recommended was ending the 10% discount that is on our electricity bills. We borrow over $1 billion, and that is a shell game. It's just basically taking money out of one pocket, putting it in another pocket, and charging it to our kids' credit card. And I think that's just wrong. Mm-hmm. And I'm disappointed that none of the other parties seem willing to even talk about that. And from a cost savings perspective, that $1 billion is one of the biggest ticket items, and the Green Party's continued to push for the implementation of that recommendation.
Mm-hmm. Now, Mike, manufacturing is still 20% of our local economy, and it's still a huge component of the provincial economy. It's obviously taken a pretty hard hit over the last number of years, and we're very fortunate in this community amongst, more so than many other parts of the province, that we have high tech, that we have biotechnology sector here in the region. Green energy solutions are fashionable and are increasingly becoming more important to the local economy. But nothing can really replace a society or an economy of doers, and manufacturing is a big part of that. We can't be just drawers of water and hewers of wood and thinkers and high or not for, or leave out the importance of manufacturing, actually doing and making things that we can sell to the rest of the world. So What's the Green Party plan to support and sustain the manufacturing sector and get it back into the importance place that it deserves and we need as a provincial economy?
Yeah, it's an excellent question. And you know, manufacturing is essential to our future. And I think one of the transitions that we're going to have to see in the manufacturing sector, and we're going to be forced to do this, is that Ontario is going to need to be a value-added, high-value, high-margin manufacturing field because we're not going to compete with low-wage jurisdictions. And so one of the opportunities that I see that exists, and I think Kitchener-Waterloo can be the leader, is according to the McKinsey Company, which is one of the leading business strategy think tanks in North America, the clean tech sector is going to represent about a $3 trillion global economic opportunity. And I think Kitchener-Waterloo is perfectly positioned to be the clean tech sector leader in North America. And I say that for a couple of reasons. One, because there's already a manufacturing base there. We have, you know, the history of technology with REM and other tech companies in the KW area, and we have the trained workforce to be a leader. And so some of the things that you know, clean tech folks tell me is we need tax credits for investment in R&D, but in particular commercialization of clean tech. So we go from that one step that you suggested of not just being the thinker, but actually being the doer and commercializing products and manufacturing them and seizing the opportunity that clean tech offers. So why not have a flow through investment tax credit for clean tech like you have for other industries in Ontario? I think the government itself could be investing in purchasing emerging technologies, particularly in the energy efficiency field, rather than spending, for instance, you know, $36 billion on new nuclear. We could take the same money, retrofit our homes at about half the cost, save the same amount of energy, and create 90 times more jobs. And so it's that kind of smart investment that I think will put KW and Ontario at the forefront of this emerging global opportunity.
Mike, under the province's Places to Grow document, we're identified as one of the growth areas in Ontario. Yet 40 years after the talk started, the land acquisition for Highway 7 hasn't even taken place yet. This has gone, you know, well beyond the good to have project status. It's now a desperate need that we need it today, let alone what the situation will be in 7 years when the project is done, even if it starts today. So in the region of Waterloo, nearly $1 billion will be spent on a light rail project to move people, yet the movement of goods and services, the backbone of our entire economy, is not getting that attention. For 40 years, Highway 7 has been discussed, assessed, and evaluated. Realignment or recreation of 424 between 403 and 401 has for years been talked about and on the agenda. Mid-Peninsula Transportation Corridor has been studied and confirmed as a requirement for years and years and years. Highway 7 is now a parking lot from our perspective here, and we hear it all the time that it's not even a place where hitchhiking has become almost obsolete at this point. So 80% of what we produce in Ontario needs to move. Unfortunately, much of it, you know, via the road networks, no matter how we look at it, the road networks are critically important for moving those goods and services that we need. So while there's a lot of important aspects, you know, of society and of the government, you know, having a robust economy provides that wealth for the government to deal with that. What level of priority does the Green Party place on transportation infrastructure, and maybe even in particular Highway 7?
Well, I think transportation infrastructure is essential, and I think when you talk about places to grow, I think good planning is essential. You know, my belief is that we have to have strong local economies, and the backbone of those strong local economies is small and medium-sized businesses, which is why the Green Party supports lowering payroll taxes on small businesses to make it cheaper and easier for them to create jobs. From a transportation perspective, I think what I'm about ready to say may not make you happy, but I want you to listen to me anyway, because I think it's important for politicians to be honest and really straightforward.
Absolutely.
The Green Party is opposed to the new Highway 7, and I want to tell you why, and it's not because we don't value transportation. It's because as a small business owner, I like to use the Wayne Gretzky approach to hockey in my investment decisions. I want to invest where the puck's going to be, not where it is right now. And I think the future of transportation is going to have to be in really cost-effective modes of transportation, and rail being one of the most important. I mean, I think what history has shown us over the last 50 years is that building more roads doesn't solve our congestion problems. It actually typically leads to more congestion. And so I think we're going to have to start investing in different modes of transportation for both moving people and goods. The second important thing we have to keep into consideration is that, you know, most economists have, are in agreement that fuel prices are going to continue to rise. And as global economic output increases, fuel costs are going to go up. And then, you know, if a recession hits, fuel prices are going to go down. But the trend line is that they're going to keep going up. And I think the smart, prudent investment is to invest in modes of transportation like rail that are going to be more affordable in a high-cost world. And then my third point, which I think is particularly important in the Waterloo region, is that the food and farming sector, and you know, is the whole food supply chain, now is the province's leading employer. It's one of the biggest contributors to the provincial economy. And we can't continue to eat up farmland. Mm-hmm. And I'm worried about the amount of farmland lost in a new Highway 7 project, and I think that farmland is going to be essential to our economy, and it's also going to be essential to the security of our country. I mean, if you can't feed yourself, you're less secure than a country that can't defend itself. So I'm all for transportation improvements on Highway 7, such as, you know, left turn lanes were appropriate, passing lanes were appropriate, paved shoulders, so we have safety for all road users. But I think the more prudent investment is to look at some alternative modes of transportation, and particularly rail.
Mike, thanks for your time. We appreciate it.
Hey, appreciate it. No problem.
Mike Schreiner is the leader of the Ontario Green Party. We are continuing our election theme this afternoon. We will continue the discussion with representatives of the other parties as Business to Business, powered by Allstream, continues. Welcome back to Business on 570 News. Well, we all know the big by-election is coming up on Thursday, September the 6th. And joining us now in conversation with Ian McLean is Brad Duguid. He is the Minister of Economic Development and Innovation with the McGuinty government. And Brad, thank you very much for joining us.
I'm pleased to join you.
All right. Ian, take it away.
Well, thank you, Minister. We appreciate you taking the time to join us. I know it's a busy time with the legislature being recalled to deal with the teachers' issue, so it's a busy time for you and your colleagues, so thanks for joining us.
It definitely is a busy time, but important work to be done, and we're pleased to be here doing it.
Good. Well, to start off, we're pleased that we've had the leader of the Green Party, and we'll have the leaders of the other parties, and you're yourself representing the Liberal Party. This election is important for the province, but I wanted to start with how important you believe this is for your party and for your leader. There's a lot of implications. Most by-elections don't have this kind of impact. So, what do you see as being the impact on your party, on the Liberal Party, and on Premier McGuinty?
Well, you know, we focus on the task at hand, and we kind of leave the political analysis to the pundits when it comes to the importance of by-elections and things like that. Of course, we're in this by-election to win, and we're in the by-election in Vaughan to win, and our goal will be to convince the people in Kitchener-Waterloo that the course that we've taken in driving ahead and building a strong economy and creating jobs is exactly what the Kitchener-Waterloo area needs now, and we need the stability to stick to that course and to continue to make the important decisions that we need to make to balance our budget and continue to build a strong economy and create jobs.
Well, and I guess that leads into, I don't want to go back too far, but the Drummond Report came out in the spring, and I know the Ontario Chamber, by and large, agreed with the direction of that the government took in terms of its reaction to the Drummond Report. Both our chamber and KW and the Cambridge Chamber and my colleague Greg DeRocher expressed concerns that since not all the recommendations, in fact, probably only half of the recommendations are being implemented, What's the plan to clear the deficit while still making the investments required to create jobs and improve the economy? As Minister, I think Finance Minister Duncan said, only a little more than half of the recommendations are to be implemented. But Mr. Drummond made quite clear that if he didn't accept all 362, he had to make some other choices to come up with the number that actually cleared a deficit and got us back on a healthy fiscal track. So what is the plan to eliminate the deficit while still focusing on job creation?
Well, the Drummond report was extremely helpful in outlining a number of areas that we can work on to get our books in balance. Our last budget outlined our plan, and that will get us balanced by 2017, 2018. It'll do so in a balanced way. We're not going to cut teachers. The PC party would suggest that that's what we should be doing. That's a recommendation we rejected. Full-day kindergarten is important. It's important for our economy. It's important to continue to build the best workforce in the world. And you do that by having the best education system in the world. We're well on the way to being there. So we're going to protect the investments that we've made in building that strong education system, that world-competitive education system. We're going to protect the investments we've made in healthcare, but we're going to take a number of other measures, including freezing wages, which is something that's very, very important for us to do, because we want to make sure that that those that are vulnerable in our society are still getting the services they need, that our kids are getting the education they need to be able to compete in that globally competitive global economy. And we need to ensure that our healthcare system remains competitive. But in our budget, we've outlined a number of measures we've taken to reduce spending. And by 2017-2018, if implemented, we will have that deficit slayed and we'll have it eliminated.
Now, so moving into something a little more local, but I think still has implications across the broader region and indeed the province. The Places to Grow Act identifies our area as a growth area, as you know, and we have seen investments in infrastructure in our post-secondary education, the community college and our colleges and universities, which is great. And we do have the commitment of for light rail transit. But one of the issues that we have, both our chambers and in conjunction with the Guelph Chamber of Commerce, have passed a resolution talking about the immediacy and the urgency of moving forward on Highway 7. And I guess to be equally critical, this has been an issue that's been on the radar screen for over 40 years and it's crossed every partisan stripe of government. But Highway 7 has become basically a parking lot at rush hours in the morning and the afternoon. And it's something that the business community here believes is really important to move goods and services and to keep our economy growing. So what's the plan specifically in terms of timing of when this is going to happen? I know we've heard announcements before, and with the greatest respect, announcements are fine. But when are we actually going to see shovels in the ground?
Well, if we're going to get this done, our track record on infrastructure is second to none. We've spent record amounts of dollars rebuilding the infrastructure of this province, and Kitchener-Waterloo area, as you mentioned, has been the beneficiary of a great deal of that, whether it be the extension and expansion of our GO Train service or whether it be the $300 million that we're providing for rapid transit, which is the single largest investment in transit infrastructure in the history of the region. We've also fully committed to building that Highway 7 expansion. We know how important it is. We've all driven on the roads. The Kitchener-Waterloo area is booming economically. We see the growth. When I talk to local companies out there, they tell me that the commute around that region now is a lot greater than it used to be. And I think the growth of that ICT sector, which is so exciting in Kitchener-Waterloo, needs that strong infrastructure to keep it going. We recognize that. We see how critical it is. And that's why the Premier announced that we're committed to getting this Highway 7 project done. It will get done, just like the other infrastructure projects that we've committed to do in the past.
And we did touch on the public sector wage freeze, and you know, across the business community, there's nothing but support for that, given the difficulties in the deficit, and recognizing that most businesses have not seen increases of any sort for a number of years. But one of the things that's been in the newspapers is the bonuses to some of the public sector senior bureaucrats recently, and most citizens and business owners find that ridiculous and outrageous given the big deficits provincially. So, I mean, just in the context of fiscal responsibility and achieving that, what are the plans to sort of address those to bring confidence back to the community that the plans that you talked about earlier in terms of eliminating the deficit are real and are understood by government?
Well, let's be very clear about that so-called bonus issue. That's the salary structure that was put in place long before we came into government. It was put in place by Tim Hudak when he was in cabinet in the Harris government. We inherited it. What we've recognized in this latest round is about 98% or so of public servants that are affected by that are getting increased pay as a result. What the Premier said is that doesn't sound like work for performance anymore. It sounds like just pay. So the Premier's asked that be investigated, that we look at that to see what's the best, most responsible way to respond. And my expectation is we'll be responding very, very soon in a responsible, thoughtful way, because it, whatever we do does need to be fair to those workers. At the same time, has to recognize the fiscal challenge we have. So not an easy issue, hugely complicated, because that process has been in place for a long time. And it may well be that these so-called bonuses or pay for success is something that now is permeated into their regular pay. So we're looking at it very, very seriously, recognizing that in these challenging times, we need to be fair, but we also need to be firm.
Okay, and just as we wrap up, we appreciate you taking the time. I guess, I mean, I know you don't want to talk necessarily about the politics, but the politics are pretty important. These two by-elections could mean the difference between a Liberal majority and a continued minority situation. So what would it mean, and how would you use a majority if you won the riding of Kitchener-Waterloo and the riding of Vaughan? What does it mean for a Liberal if it's a Liberal majority?
Well, you know, I think we live in a very uncertain time. The global economy is uncertain. We've put in place the fundamentals to build a strong economy here in Ontario, and much of those investments are accruing in Kitchener-Waterloo as we see that information communication technology sector booming. We've got to keep moving in that direction, and we need the stability of a majority government to do that. We look at this recent teacher issue. We see the NDP wanting to give teachers an increase in pay despite the tough times. We see the PC party wanting to fire 10,000 teachers and another 10,000 support workers in our education system and do away with full-day learning, which is really important to our future economy. We believe that the McGuinty government and the Liberal Party and our candidate, Eric Davis, strikes the right balance to build a strong economy and provides the stability we need to move forward in this uncertain global environment. More than that, to make Ontario a global economic leader. That's the track we're on. That's what we're asking the people of Kitchener-Waterloo to support so that we can continue to create jobs and continue to make Ontario an economic powerhouse in this post-recession, very uncertain global economy.
Mr. Duguid, thank you very much for your time today.
And it's my pleasure. Nice talking to you. Look forward to chatting with you sometime soon.
Thanks so much.
That was Brad Duguid. He is the Minister of Economic Development and Innovation, representing the Liberal Party as we continue along the theme of politics heading into Thursday's by-election. You're listening to Business, powered by Allstream on 570 News. Welcome back to Business, powered by Allstream on 570 News. We continue our theme of politics as we head into the by-election on Thursday. Politics from a business perspective. And joining us now is the leader of the Ontario New Democratic Party, Andrea Horvath, and she's in conversation now with Ian McLean. Ian, take it away.
Well, thank you and welcome, Andrea. We appreciate you taking the time today. I know how busy you are with the legislature being recalled to deal with the issue surrounding teachers. So thank you for taking the time this morning.
Well, it's my pleasure, Ian, and thank you for the invitation.
Good. Well, just to start, and one of the things that our chamber, but both the Cambridge Chamber and the Kitchener-Waterloo Chamber have been talking about for several months since the Drummond Report was released was the notion that we, while the Ontario Chamber supported broadly the way that the government responded to it, our two chambers were pretty critical about the fact that Drummond's report was very comprehensive and in-depth with 362 recommendations that I think tried to strike the balance between eliminating the deficit and continue to make investments. I guess the question I would ask, so you can tell our listeners, is the government moved on maybe half of those or approximately half of those and has a target of 2017-18 to eliminate the deficit. How would you and Andrea Horvath and the New Democratic Party responded to the Drummond Report itself?
Well, I mean, there's a couple of things that we supported in the Drummond Report that we thought were smart and made a lot of sense. I mean, I think particularly about some of his comments around the healthcare sector and having nurses utilize their full scope of practice and having, you know, greater integration in terms of delivering of health services. There's other parts, however, that I thought were problematic. For example, Mr. Drummond seemed to infer in his report that a focus on job creation should not be primary, that in fact it should be the opposite. They should really look at the deficit reduction piece, but not so much job creation as an initiative, and pretty much said that manufacturing is gone forever and gone for good. Those things, I think, are wrong-headed, and I didn't actually agree with Mr. Drummond's recommendations in that regard. Look, one of the things that we're seeing is, again, the other thing he actually suggested is getting rid of, a targeted approach to helping with business and helping with investment in terms of trying to get some economic activity stimulated in Ontario. And I disagree with that as well, frankly. We've seen the across-the-board approach, and we've seen it not work. Right? We've seen the across-the-board tax cuts, and even the governor of the Bank of Canada is saying it's really gotten us nothing except for lots of big companies sitting on a heck of a lot of cash, but not much investment and not much job creation. So I don't think you can take Mr. Drummond's report, holus bolus, and implement it. I don't think that would have been the right thing to do. Having said that, I think that there are things that we need to continue to do to make Ontario's economy stronger and make Ontario's families more particularly feel confident about the future.
Now, this obviously is an important election for our ridings in Kitchener-Waterloo and more broadly for the region. To have a representative taking our issues around post-secondary education, high-tech, manufacturing to Queen's Park. But what does this mean to you and the New Democratic Party and your leadership? I mean, and I guess really what will the results in these two by-elections say about your leadership and what people believe about the New Democratic Party?
Well,
what success in these two by-elections?
Well, I mean, I think already we've had a great deal of success with the by-elections. I mean, we've got great candidates in both of those by-elections. Catherine Fife, of course, in Kitchener-Waterloo, I would say is the best person to be able to represent that riding. Certainly, she can hit the road running in terms of her experience and her capacity. She's a perfect fit for the riding. So as a leader, that's always a positive thing, to have good candidates that are prepared to run under your banner and who support your leadership and who are well respected in their community. So in some ways, I think that we've already made some real positive gains, I guess, if you want to call it that, just by virtue of having such a fantastic candidate, and in fact being in a serious three-way race where perhaps in the past it might not have been considered to be likely that the NDP would be in a serious race in this riding, but we certainly are, and we're looking forward to seeing what happens on September 6th. I think it's anybody's election to win. I've been In Kitchener-Waterloo many, many times, and will be continuing to go there both, you know, up until September 6th and likely afterwards as well, because it represents really what a heck of a lot of Ontario is going through. People are worried about access to health care, particularly access to family doctors. They're concerned about good jobs and the ability of good jobs to be found again, since so many have been lost. And they're really, really worried about the cost of everyday living. I mean, people are still finding it hard to make ends meet and don't see, you know, the attention being paid to their struggles.
You know, Places to Grow Act says we're a area identified for growth. And frankly, this cuts across all partisan lines. For 40 years, all provincial governments have been talking about Highway 7 and the importance of widening that as a corridor, not only for the region but for the province. So, where does the New Democratic Party stand on Highway 7? What would be your plan to make that a priority for the provincial government, whether it's a Liberal minority or majority? Where do you stand on Highway 7, and when would you like to see the shovels in the ground?
Well, I mean, it's obviously, and you've stated it, it's a project long past due, and it needs to get underway. And it's interesting that, you know, finally it looks like there might be a commitment to make it happen. It's unfortunate that it took a by-election to have that happen, but you know what, I certainly don't begrudge the people in your region from finally getting that put up to the front burner, because it's been lingering in the back burner for a long, long time. But look, one of the things that we committed to when we put our platform together for the last election was making sure that we had extra infrastructure money available. So regular infrastructure money, yes, but also an extra pile of money specifically for roads and bridges. Because we know that particularly smaller communities and rural communities need to have that investment and need to be able to rely on you know, extra support for those kinds of projects, because the roadways, road transportation is, you know, pretty much the only game in town, if you will, when it comes to moving of goods and people. Now, luckily, or I guess that's up in the air in terms of the opinion of people in the region, but certainly the light rail system will bring some new different opportunities, I think, to your area, and that's a positive thing as well. But this road has been long past due in terms of its actual shovel in the ground readiness. And you know, I hope this is not just another cynical announcement that's going to fall off the radar. Certainly, if Catherine Fife is representing that area, the Kitchener-Waterloo riding, come September 7th, then we will definitely be pushing to make sure that the promise being made in the context of the election actually takes shape into a reality finally.
Good. Now, time's running short. I know you have to get back into the House probably, but one of the things that, you know, the public sector wage freeze that the Liberals have talked about is top of mind for a lot of folks, especially businesses that haven't seen increases for themselves or for their employees in many years, given the tough economic times. But more recently, the senior bureaucrat bureaucrats in the public sector getting what are described as bonuses. What's your position on both a broader public sector wage freeze as well as the bonuses for senior bureaucrats?
Well, let's start with the latter first, and maybe the entire ball of wax is kind of ironic. I mean, here the government's been talking wage freeze for so long, but you know, I guess a wage freeze for some people is better than a wage freeze for all people, or some people can be more frozen than others. And obviously, with the managers and the bonuses, they weren't frozen. But look, there's no doubt that there's pressure right now, and there's no doubt that there's a necessity to get the deficit under control. I believe the best way to tackle that is through the proper process of discussions. And what we're going to end up with now is a piece of legislation that is going to be challenged at the Supreme Court. And I got to tell you, if we lose that challenge, and it's likely that we will, we're going to end up paying upwards of $800 million in a couple years' time. That is not going to help us with the deficit. In fact, it's going to cost us over double of what the government's talking about in terms of the current contract rolling over. So I think that the teachers know that it's tough times. They've even said they're prepared to take the rate with the wage freeze. And I think that, you know, had the government decided to spend more time figuring out how to get over the last couple of hurdles, we wouldn't be in a situation where we're likely to get a hefty bill in a couple of years' time, the taxpayers are, in terms of the cost of this initiative.
Ms. Horvath, thank you very much for your time today. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Ian.
Thank you, Andrea.
Take care.
That was Andrea Horvath, the Ontario NDP leader, in conversation with Ian McLean, the president of the Greater Kitchener-Waterloo Chamber of Commerce. You are listening to Business, powered by Allstream on 570 News. Welcome back to Business, powered by Allstream on 570 News. We are delighted to have with us now the leader of the Progressive Conservative Party of Ontario, Mr. Tim Hudak. Greg, take it away with Tim.
Tim, welcome and thanks for joining us here on Business to Business.
Hey, my pleasure.
Listen, you know, this election, these by-elections mean different things to different people, of course. We've coined it as probably the most significant by-elections in Ontario's history. But what we really want to know is how important is this to Tim Hudak and the Conservative Party in Ontario? And in going forward with your agenda, recognizing that even if you won both of them, you wouldn't have that majority government, but certainly it would be a huge feather in your cap. And maybe more particularly because we're interested, how important is this to you and the party to win the KW by-election?
Well, you know, obviously it's important in two frames here. Let me say both. I mean, first of all, we got a great candidate in Tracy Wilder. I mean, this is one who worked at RIM. She's now an instructor at the MBA program at Wolfe Laurier University. She has her CA background. So somebody who knows business, has that kind of experience, and is really focused on creating jobs and stopping the overspending we're seeing in the current government. So she'd be a great addition to our team and help fill the shoes of Elizabeth Whitmer, who was there before. And then secondly, you know, in a province-wide point of view, Greg, you make a good point. And this is all about setting a tone for the province, because I bet you most people listening think that we're on the wrong path in Ontario. We're spending too much money. We're seeing too much waste. We're digging a deep hole. And we have 600,000 women and men who woke up this morning with no job to go to, because this mighty engine of job creation that always been Ontario has stalled. Mm-hmm. And that's why we have our own plan out there, a bold conservative plan to turn our province around, to fire up the economy. This is a chance for folks in the by-election to say, you know what, we like that route, let's try a change in the province.
You know, Tim, this is maybe old news to some degree, but the Drummond Report cited 362 recommendations in order to meet the target of eliminating the deficit by 2017-2018. His report was very clear and said that all of the 362 recommendations must be adopted or replaced with actually better ideas. Now, the government, according to Minister Duncan, has moved on little more than half of the Drummond recommendations. How many would Tim Hudak have implemented, and what would Tim Hudak have implemented that would have been better ideas?
Geez, I could probably go on for the rest of the show on this, so let me try to get the point here. Well, first of all, you know, I think we got to put out a missing persons announcement on Don Drummond. I mean, the guy did some really good work. He did some heavy lifting. It was the first honest appraisal of the province's finances and a path forward to get us out of this hole. But since he tabled that report, Greg, what, back in March, mm-hmm. It sort of just disappeared off the radar. It's almost like that report was put immediately on the shelf, and that's a real shame. So our MPPs, like Rob Leone, Michael Harris, and Tracy, hopefully if she's elected, going through that piece by piece to say, okay, we got to move forward. We got to start making some of the tough decisions to turn our province around. Because Greek politicians were at a crossroads like this 15 years ago, and what do? They just kicked the can down the road, and now they're in a huge mess. And nobody wants to see Ontario become the Greece of Canada.
No,
so,
for sure.
Let me give you a few examples. It's part of our plan, and folks can see the plan at tracywiler.ca. First of all, an across-the-board wage freeze for all of us. Teachers, sure, but also firefighters, doctors, nurses, MPPs. I think that's fair and reasonable. It'll save $2 billion a year for a minimum of 2 years, and then give you time to reduce the size and cost of government. We need to fix a broken arbitration system that is seeing arbitrators give out agreements to public sector union leaders that are way out of line with what taxpayers can afford. Not too far down the highway from you in Stratford, an arbitrator gave firefighters a 20% wage increase. Now, I respect the work our firefighters do. They're highly trained individuals. They put their lives on the line. But how many of your listeners got a 20% pay increase last year? You got to ground that in reality.
That's
the third
for sure.
One I'm bringing up in the House, in the legislature all week, 98% of bureaucrats got bonus pay increases. 98%. You know, they're supposed to have their wages frozen, and there is this back door. So I would close that loophole. I would make sure it's an across-the-board wage freeze. That gives you a start to reduce the size and cost of government. I could probably go on longer, but I'll leave you with those three bullet points.
Tim Hudak, Ontario PC Party leader, in conversation with Greg DeRocher of the Cambridge Chamber of Commerce. You're listening to Business, powered by Allstream on 570 News.
Tim, you know, under the Places to Grow document from the province, this area is identified as one of the growth areas for the next 40 years. Yet, 40 years after the talk started about Highway 7 expansion, you know, we're still sitting there. It's a parking lot now. Hitchhikers even avoid going on Highway 7 because they know they can get there faster if they walk. But we also have projects like Highway 424 that was talked about. We have the Mid-Peninsula Transportation Corridor. We have all of these infrastructures that are really meant to move the goods and services because, you know, the old saying is if you bought it, a truck brought it. We need to have these road infrastructure projects in order to keep our economy vibrant and strong, not to mention supporting that manufacturing industry that we desperately need. What would a Tim Hudak government, or in opposition, how is Tim Hudak going to present the case that we need to get on with these projects?
You know, it wasn't too long ago where people would come in from the states, other provinces, other countries, and marvel at Ontario's highway system. We'd actually had the foresight to invest in it, and then people could get to and from work or their family safely and on time. And it also meant that we could actually ship goods to market. We've lost sight of that. You know, what was the last time we had a major highway project actually built in this province? And, Greg, you made an excellent point. You can't ship auto parts or steel or wood on an LRT. You can't ship it on a bus. No doubt transit helps us get around, but if we don't invest in our highways, we're going to choke our job-creating system. Mm-hmm. So that's why we've actually put a plan forward to stop the overspending, cut out the waste like we've seen at eHealth in Orange, get public sector pay and benefits grounded in the realities of what's actually happening in the private sector so we can afford to invest in what's dear to us, like healthcare for our loved ones and infrastructure that's going to relate and create jobs down the road. We've always been a trading nation. It's helped to fuel our economy. It's helped to build our middle class. And I'm really worried we've gotten away from that and lost the balance between transit and highway systems that will support jobs.
So we know Tim Hudak's going to fight for Highway 7.
Yeah, absolutely, as will Tracy Wyler. I mean, I could have Tracy, Rob Leone, and Michael.
We're going to have them all fighting for it.
I only have two arms, so they're going to give me a third one to get it twisted behind my back. But there's a classic example right there. It should have been done. It's been promised and overpromised. Let's get on with it.
For sure. Our two chambers, the Greater KW Chamber and the Cambridge Chamber, support the public sector wage freeze. In our travels, you know, both chambers, that's all we hear. Of course, I guess, mind you, some people might say, well, you're just talking to the business community. But you know what? That's the small business community. We're, you know, we're talking about 75-80% of the population out there are involved with or own small businesses. Tax Freedom Day today is June 6th. Nearly 50% of our income tax is going to government and to provide the support services that they're doing. And yet we see this constant waste, and you talked a little bit about it with Orange and some of the other programs. If this is challenged and defeated, what will be the cut in order to reach the deficit reduction target next? Recognizing that Ontarians simply cannot be taxed anymore.
No, we can't. And I worry that government has lost sight of the basic fact that you can't have good public services unless you have a healthy, thriving private sector. And, you know, and another basic principle is that public sector pay and benefits have to reflect the ability of private sector families to pay the bills. And we've seen wage and benefits and pensions for the public sector that are just way out of whack with what's happening in the real world. So a wage freeze, you know, we've been pushing that for over a year across the board. I mentioned that earlier, but let's not lose track. That's kind of like treading water, Greg.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't do any damage, but it doesn't get you out of the deep end.
Mm-hmm. Well, I kind of wondered that. I wondered a freeze. Well, we spent $15 billion too much last year. Are cuts not in order? I guess that's my confusion.
The answer is exactly that. So a freeze will buy you some time. It doesn't make the situation worse, but it doesn't get you out of the hole. So you need to actually reduce the size and cost of the government. We need to shrink its size because we can't afford the amount of government that we currently have. Secondly, you have to make sure that wages and benefits and pensions reflect what's actually happening in the private sector. You know, the deal used to be in the past that if you worked for government, you had job security, and in return, you didn't get the same pay and benefits as the private sector, where you risk your company closing down, your small business shutting its doors. Now the world is on its head, where you have the job security of the public service and pay and pensions that, Greg, you know, if you woke up and dreamt about, you'd have to apologize.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So it's not going to make any big, you know, parades at the teacher union or officer union headquarters for me or for Tracy. But, you know, it's time we had some straight talk in the province. Mm-hmm. We can only have as much government as we can afford.
Yeah, for sure. Tim Hudak, leader of the official opposition, the Progressive Conservative Party of Ontario, thank you very much for taking the time to come and speak with us today.
Oh, my pleasure. And listen, thanks for the work that you guys are doing for the chambers in Cambridge and Kitchener-Waterloo, the jobs that your members create. I hope to have a chance to work with you to see even more of that in the time ahead.
Thank you.
Right, thank you, Mr. Hudak. Tim Hudak, Ontario PC Party leader, our guest on Business to Business, powered by Allstream on 570 News.